Support comes from The Music Shop, celebrating 51 years of service to music education. The Music Shop serves over 200 school music programs with band and orchestra instruments, a large sheet music department, thousands of accessories, and private lessons at 27 East Market View Drive in Market View Plaza, Champaign, or at themusicshop.com.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL at 1240. I'm Jim Meadows, filling in for Craig Cohen. Members of Congress returned to Washington today for a last brief session of lawmaking before the November election. Among the things likely to be left unfinished is a new five-year farm bill. The current one expires at the end of this month. But as NPR's Julie Rovner reports, the consequences are not that dire.
Farmers and other supporters of the bill that funds a broad swath of agriculture, nutrition, and conservation programs gathered on the west front of the Capitol last week to express their frustration. Bucking this year's trend of partisan discord, the Senate passed a bipartisan farm bill in June. The House Agriculture Committee passed a different but also bipartisan bill in July. But House GOP leaders have refused to bring that bill to the floor. And it appears now they won't vote on a short-term extension before the current law expires September 30th either, said Senate Agriculture Committee Chair Debbie Stabenow, Democrat of Michigan.
We know that if the farm bill is allowed to expire and things begin to unwind, we turn back the clock in rural America to 1949. And you know what that means. Government planning restrictions, expensive price supports, and we'd see the markets, frankly, in total disarray. It's crazy.
Stabenow's referring to the fact that in the absence of a farm bill, the farm commodity programs revert back to something called the Agricultural Act of 1949. It would result in farmers getting some very high prices from the government, says Vincent Smith. He's a professor of economics at Montana State University.
For example, the price that farmers would be paid by the government for wheat would be $13.58 a bushel. Well, that compares with a record almost market price today for wheat of $8. So you can see this is a lot of money here that could potentially flow out of the treasury to the farmers.
Of course, there would be losers, too. Dairy farmers would see a key program expire, even though they've been paying record high prices for feed. But the fact is, nothing really dire is likely to happen, at least not right away, says Mary Kay Thatcher. She's with the American Farm Bureau Federation.
We actually have until about January 1st, before we run into a lot of administrative problems, with this bill reverting to some very high prices.
That's because the existing farm bill, even though it will technically expire, will still cover 2012 crops, even those that haven't been harvested yet. Big problems wouldn't crop up, as it were, until next year, she says.
The first crop that would come time for harvest would be next spring when we harvest winter wheat.
So what's been holding things up? Thatcher says it's mostly the non-farm parts of the bill, particularly nutrition funding like the $78 billion food stamp program.
You have the Senate that's cut about $4 billion out of the food stamp program. You have the House that's cut about $16 billion. In general, you've got a lot of Tea Party Republicans that would like to cut way more than $16 billion. In general, you got a lot of Democrats that would like to cut zero.
And what accounts for the panic in farm country over not having a farm bill? Some is that farmers want the certainty of knowing what the ground rules will be for the next 5 years. But there's something else, says Vincent Smith. Budget politics and what might happen if this year's bill slips into next year.
They want to have a farm bill now that locks Congress and the taxpayer into obligations based on either the Senate or the House bill. What they're concerned about is that if serious deficit reduction talks take place, then a lot more money will have to come out of the farm bill.
Meanwhile, a bit of trivia. When's the last time Congress allowed the farm bill to expire temporarily? That would be 2007, the last time it was up for renewal. The sky didn't fall then, either. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
Our week-long series on the 60s counterculture in Champaign-Urbana continues now. It's produced by students from University Laboratory High School in Urbana in partnership with WILL. Today we hear one woman's personal story about protesting the Vietnam War while a student at the University of Illinois. Today's report is produced and voiced by Uni High sophomore Linus Derbach.
While nonviolence was certainly a part of the 60s, violent protests also took place. On the University of Illinois campus, students actively staged physical, attention-grabbing protests. Debbie Cox was part of a protest that started out peaceful.
About noon, there was a demonstration began in the electrical engineering building where the recruiters were. Students sat down. Police came, tried to remove us, and we locked arms, and they started removing us. But some of the students became violent. They wouldn't allow themselves to be removed. They started resisting, and they started throwing chairs, and they started throwing rocks through windows, and I left immediately. So I went back to my dorm, and I had a knitting lesson that night. And so I went to the art mart. I was on the second floor learning how to knit when I heard rocks being hurled through the windows of the businesses down below. And the owner of the art mart said, don't anyone go out until law and order has been reestablished. I looked out and I thought, oh my goodness, the revolution is happening. People are going to ask me where I was on this night, and I'm going to have to say I was taking a knitting lesson. I'm going to join the revolution.
Cox ended up joining that protest, knitting it all. A little while later, the police arrived.
They came to the intersection there in front of the alma mater, and a few of the students, including the male student next to me, started hurling, you know, epithets at them. Here come the pigs, oink, oink, you know. And one of the policemen stopped and said, okay, you're violating curfew, you're going in. And I said, hey, what about me? Isn't this a little bit of a double standard? Don't you want to take me? I'm still out here, and it's curfew. The policeman said, oh, no, we want you to go back to your dorm. It's too rough for you out here, young lady, which incensed me. I said, you've got to take both of us. So I said, okay, I'll give you a reason for taking me, and I kicked him in the shins. And then he really changed his tone. He said, okay, sister, get in, and clamped the handcuffs on me and took me to the jail, where I spent the night in maximum security. And I became very incensed. I think that's why they put me in maximum security. They said, okay, you want to protest, we'll give you protest.
Can't stand it no more. People dying, crying for help for so many years.
Today's segment of Beyond the Tie-Dye was produced and voiced by University Laboratory High School sophomore Linus Erbach. Series continues tomorrow here on the Afternoon Magazine. And hear more of the story on the one-hour documentary of Beyond the Tie-Dye, Counterculture in Champaign-Urbana, 1965-75, this Saturday at 6 p.m. on WYLL AM 580 and streaming on will.illinois.edu. A group of Illinois residents are asking the state Supreme Court to throw out the state's system of funding schools. They say the reliance on property taxes means wealthier areas and poorer ones are treated unequally. Brian Mackey has more.
The property owners say because they don't live in wealthy areas, they're stuck paying a higher tax rate to meet the state's minimum funding level for schools, known as the foundation level. Attorney Alexander Polakoff argues because wealthier districts can reach that level with a lower tax rate, state law discriminates against his clients who pay taxes in less well-off areas.
The consequence of the unequal treatment is that the tax energy, if you will, of poor districts is exhausted by reaching the foundation level.
But Assistant Attorney General Paul Burks argues the foundation level is not a requirement on local schools. He says it's a guide for how much money state government should send to the state's least well-off districts.
The statute, in fact, provides vastly superior subsidies to the plaintiff school districts than to the supposedly favored school districts.
This case has the potential to fundamentally change how Illinois pays for education. But in a landmark case 16 years ago, the Supreme Court rejected another challenge to Illinois' education funding system. I'm Brian Mackey.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday, September the 19th, 2012. It's the birthday of William Golding, born in Cornwall, England, 1911. His first novel, also his best-known book, Lord of the Flies, written when he was working as a schoolteacher, rejected 21 times before a new editor at Faber & Faber in London decided to take a chance on it. It was on this date in 1940, a Polish soldier named Witold Pilecki allowed himself to be captured by the Nazis. He was a captain in the Polish resistance, and he wanted to find out what was going on near the town of Auschwitz. His superiors thought it was just a German camp for prisoners of war, but Pilecki suspected that something else was happening. So he joined a group of Polish citizens who were being rounded up by Nazis. Pilecki, leaving behind a wife and two young children, was taken to Auschwitz. He was given a number, 4859, and he soon realized that this was a Nazi death camp. He stayed there for 3 years. He smuggled out detailed reports of what was happening, reported on the gas chambers and the ovens to dispose of human remains. And his reports were so horrific that nobody in the Polish underground believed him. His reports made their way to the British and the Americans. He suggested ways to liberate the camp, but still nothing was done. Finally, in 1943, Pilecki, frustrated by the lack of action, faked a case of typhus. He escaped from the hospital. After the war, the Polish underground recruited him to spy on the Soviets, and he was captured by the Polish communist regime, executed for espionage in 1948. It was on this date, 1934, that Bruno Hauptmann was arrested for the kidnapping and murder of Charles Lindbergh's baby. He was convicted of the murder and executed on the basis of circumstantial evidence. His widow, Anna, spent the rest of her life trying to have the verdict overturned, but to no avail. And it was 30 years ago today, in 1982, a computer scientist named Scott Fallman first suggested the use of a colon, a hyphen, and a parenthesis to represent happy and sad faces, the first emoticons. Here's a poem for today by Stephen Dobbins, Cézanne's Seclusion. "I have begun to think," he wrote in a late letter, "that one cannot help others at all." This from a man who once called friendship the highest virtue.